This podcast was originally recorded on November 19th, 2019, as part of a live meetup with the founder of the no-code platform Bubble.io. As such, some parts of this interview may be out of date. Indie Worldwide hosts multiple live meetups and live-streamed interviews with indie founders every month. You can find links to our next meetup at indieworldwide.co.
Welcome to Indie Hackers Worldwide. We have with us Emmanuel, the co-founder, co-CEO of Bubble.io. Emmanuel, tell us your story.
Well, it's great to be here. The Indie Hacker community has always been very, have very strong overlap with our own community. So it's really great to be here. So I'll talk a little bit about myself very quickly, and then I'll get into what Bubble is about. So I guess as a lot of people can hear, I'm originally from France, I grew up in France, went to college in France, and then I actually moved quite a bit. And in some ways I got into the entrepreneurship journey fairly late compared to, you know, a lot of success stories you hear from Silicon Valley, in the sense that I started Bubble at 29 after having been, you know, a management consultant in China for a few years, having gone to business school with an MBA, which is not necessarily, you know, the most traditional way to start a business now. There is kind of an anti-MBA thing going on in tech, and actually learn how to code on the job. So I was not really thinking I would be like a software entrepreneur for a very long time until I actually started Bubble and met Josh. And so the idea that governed us when we started the company in the first place 7 years ago, it's been a while, was to empower people to create companies without the need for engineers. And that was something that I think is true everywhere, but that was in particular true in New York, where New York has a lot of, you know, very driven people from a lot of industries that see a lot of inefficiencies in the industries they've been working on, but don't have the technical skills and don't have engineering friends, because you just don't have many engineers in New York compared to like San Francisco, for instance. And so what happened, it was not my idea originally, it was Josh's idea, so my co-founder, where he was basically in New York and he was technical and everybody was asking him, hey, can you help me build this? Can you help me build that? And he found himself too many times saying, I can't. Sometimes it could be a bad idea. Sometimes it could be a good idea, but still almost not the point. The point is, you know, there is so much creative energy that people are willing to put to something and they just don't have the ways to do it. And so that basically what was the inception of Bubble is, you know, can we create something that lets people, like business people, have a vision for a product but not the technical skills, don't write code, can we let them, you know, just build it themselves without having the need for an engineer? And so that started very early 2012. Josh started working on this for a couple of months and then realized it was kind of a too big of a project for one person. Because one way to describe it is to say, you know, enable people to start companies without engineers. Another way is to be, you know, kind of the holy grail of technology, if you will, which is, you know, can we empower people to do something that used to be difficult, very easy? If you think about it, it's exactly what was, you know, Windows versus MS-DOS, you know, like MS-DOS was, you know, how to use a computer with a command line, which was complicated. And then Macintosh and Windows came along with icons and the graphic user interface, and that was much easier. And that happened in the 80s. And a lot of people have tried to do that for code, but no one has actually succeeded to a point that, you know, we don't teach the coding in schools, except if you want to be like a specialist on the computer science side of things. And that is something that was pretty hard, definitely not for a single person. And so Josh decided to look for a co-founder. And so some friends put us in touch. I was graduating from business school at the time. I was at Harvard. Josh had gone to Harvard College a few years prior. And so we had some mutual friends, kind of the Harvard network. And so he put the word out there, he wanted a co-founder, and we met after I graduated from school. And we actually decided to partner on our first coffee. That was like a very short-term thing that we did, because I had a job offer that was expiring the following day of our coffee. And so we were like, okay, well, it's now or never, so let's just try. And so we started with that vision, and it's been the same basically since then, in a sense, you know, can we just create something that is accessible for someone who's, you know, familiar with using Microsoft Office, you know, whether it's PowerPoint or Excel, and enable them to create exactly what they envision. It took us quite some time to get there, because the amount of features you need to have to go to people and tell them, you know, seriously, without actually, you know, lying, I guess, that without making false promises, that they can do exactly what they want to do, takes a very long time. And we saw an inflection point in, you know, when people reach out, when they discover Bubble, the first thing they're going to ask, and I'm actually expecting some of the questions here to be, hey, can I do this? Can I do that? Because that's kind of the first thing you hear. And in the early years, you're going to say no most of the time. And at some point, we saw an inflection point, not an inflection point, but the curve started going in the other direction where we started saying yes more and more. And that was around late 2017, early 2018. And so for the first 5 years, we mostly worked on, you know, iterating on the product with, you know, literally 20 to 30 active users. We found a few larger startups that were using us, that were paying us enough money so that we could be, you know, what people would call like ramen profitable. So, you know, making enough money where you definitely don't get rich. You don't have a super comfortable lifestyle, but you don't lose money on working on this. And after 2017, then things started getting easier. We started having, like, in that case, an inflection point in terms of revenue, started hiring a team, got to a team of about 11 people, fully bootstrapped, fully profitable, before raising around earlier this year. And so where you can build on us, because that's always a question, like, the no-code space right now is pretty hot. Like, people talk a lot about no-code, but actually each of the players in the no-code kind of solve a different purpose and a different market. So what Bubble is for is building web applications with a backend, with connecting with APIs and with very, very custom logic. Meaning, you know, you can start doing something like, you know, if the user is logged in and his credit card is from that country, do this, otherwise do something else. And you can do that just by clicking. Like we've built an abstraction on top of, you know, code that is without code, but still extremely flexible. On the flip side, that means we have more of a learning curve than other tools. Other tools tend to be a little bit faster to grasp, but you're going to be much more limited in terms of what you can build. You know, tools like Webflow will be fantastic if you want to build like a beautiful CMS or e-commerce shop. But if you're trying to build something like Airbnb or Twitter, you will not be able to do it because they don't have the backend capabilities. That's where Bubble comes in. So for people that want to start companies, Bubble is actually, of all the tools on the market, one of the, honestly, I think the best one, in a sense that most people that want to start a web startup don't necessarily want to start an e-commerce shop, in which case they could use Shopify or Webflow, but they really want to build like a platform. You know, where the website you're building, the product is the core of your business. So think about it, you know, Airbnb is the core of their business, is this platform they've built where they have sellers and buyers on both sides of the network, of the marketplace. And so that's where Bubble comes in, and that where Bubble is probably the only tool currently on the market that lets you do this without code. The way it works is you build it on Bubble. It's actually free to build. The way we charge is on hosting. So once you're on Bubble, you don't need to worry about web services like AWS, Amazon Web Services, or Azure, or Google Cloud, because we host everything for you. In our world, you know, if you're a business person trying to think, or an entrepreneur trying to build a product, you know, again, where people can buy, can rent apartments on a short-term basis, for instance, so something like Airbnb, there's no server in what I just described. You know, what you have is just, you know, an idea, a platform, two kind of people on the marketplace, but whether you're hosting that, you know, on this server or this type of database or another one is really not your problem as a product person. And so we're trying to take care of that for you automatically. And so people build on us and they launch on us. And then after that, they scale on us. It got to a point and it took a lot of pain. I'm not going to lie, you know, scaling pain were difficult, but some of our earlier users that kept scaling on us got to a pretty impressive scale. Our largest user has had, it's a fairly complicated marketplace, not marketplace, but platform where homeowners apply to get loans, to install a solar panel on the roof. Installers have a CRM where they can see all the projects they're working on. They can get paid through the platform. So it's a pretty complicated web product that they've built entirely on Bubble, and they've processed over $1 billion of loans and raised $300 million themselves. So it's really, it scales much more than you think. I think if you think about the journey of no code, the first thing was to prove, you know, things could be built without code, regardless of the scale. Because for a long time, you know, people were like, oh, visual programming doesn't give you enough flexibility. And that first thing was to show it is actually possible. Now, the next thing is to show that it can actually scale and work great at scale. We've pretty much done with the first one. I mean, there are always some things we can improve on the product to make it more usable and easier to learn. But in terms of features, we pretty much feature complete in a sense that for the web, not for native apps, that's a different platform and different product. So that we're doing pretty well. Now we need to show that we can scale nicely. The good thing about our model is that since people tend to start companies on top of us, we scale with them basically. And so we have the same scaling plan at the same time, and that has worked pretty well so far. The beauty of the model is that whenever one startup gets ahead of another one, well, they will force us to improve the platform for everyone, because we don't do custom work. Like, we just make sure the platform scales nicely for everyone when we solve the problem for one person. So today we're based in New York. We have 19 people. Sometimes losing track because we are adding people like almost on a weekly basis right now. We have 19 people. For a very long time, it was just me and Josh, like thinking about the indie hacker community. Like, we were doing that profitable, just the two of us for 5 years. I built a lot of the customer facing product and did all of customer success myself. So we were very much understaffed, and now we're trying to staff up to be more, to have the team that is more compatible with our goal, that is to scale. And when I mean to scale, I don't talk about scaling bubble. I mean, obviously scaling bubble, but making sure our users can scale, which is almost more important. So the last thing I'll add is why we're doing this, because it kind of started a little bit with an opinionated view that the world was doing something wrong. And what I mean by that is the problem that we were seeing is that technology is so expensive today to create, because it's very hard to find engineers, that it prevents, again, a lot of people to start companies. But if you actually don't put that in the terms of, you know, are people starting companies or not, if you put that in the terms are as, you know, can people use technology to solve local problems at the local level in their local communities, what we see is that today, it's basically impossible, because engineers are very hard to find, they're very expensive. Creating software is really expensive. And so if you don't work on a piece of software that has the potential to reach like a massive valuation, like, I don't know, at least $100 million or something, it's going to be extremely hard to find investors. And if you don't have investors, then you won't make the product happen. And so the reason why we decided to do this, to fix this, by having a much cheaper way to create technology, because one way to see what we do is that we make technology much easier for non-technical people to build. But the consequence is that you can do it for basically 1/50th or 1/100th of the cost, which enables us to have a lot of people in places that you wouldn't expect a lot of startups to happen. Like, a lot of our users are actually, you know, in the Midwest, in some emerging markets where the engineering talent pool is fairly little. And they were kind of the leftovers, you know, of the technology world for quite some time, because most of the people capable of creating these things all aggregate, you know, in like major economic centers where salaries are higher. So that's, you know, the East Coast and most importantly, Silicon Valley and San Francisco, which I think leads to a lot of challenges. And so that's why we do this.
Oh, I guess my first question is, since you so recently took a round of funding, what was the impetus for doing that? And how have you noticed the company shift since then?
Yeah. I think the first way to answer that question is to answer why we didn't raise money earlier. Because today, you know, it's kind of cool to be bootstrapped, but that, you know, 5 years ago, it was really not cool at all. Like, 5 years ago, people were like, oh, you can't raise money. That must be very bad ideas. That must be really a bad startup. It has changed a lot, I think, because people started seeing what, honestly, I think we saw earlier than some others is, you know, the issues with fundraising too soon. The reason why we didn't raise money is that because it puts it puts pressure on the company in a way that is not necessarily healthy. In our case, having too many users too soon is not necessarily a good thing, because we needed to prove that we needed to make the product feature complete. Because as I was telling you, a lot of the things you're going to hear at first is, hey, can I do this? Can I do that? Until you're at a point where you say yes most of the time, you don't want to have too many users, because it's going to be a waste of time. And so that's why we were not raising money, because most investors would want to see, you know, exponential user acquisition curves. What happened earlier this year, late last year, when we decided to put the trigger on fundraising, is two things. Well, first of all, internally, we were ready to start, you know, taking more users, because we were beyond that point where we would say no, because we were feature complete. And then the market is also heating up. Like, the no-code space today has nothing to do with 2 years ago. You know, when we started in New York like 6 years ago, people were actually telling us we were stupid because everyone would learn how to code. Code Academy was, you know, the hottest startup in New York. Barack Obama was coding a few lines of JavaScript, you know, with a code.org cap on his head, and everybody thought that was so cool. And I think what people realized over the years is that it actually doesn't really work. Like, coding is not for everyone. It's pretty tedious and a pretty slow process, even if you're really good at it. And so, because the market was heating up, we were in a leading position in terms of product development. We wanted to actually extend our business footprint. And I thought, I think having a little bit more money then was very valuable for the business. The change it has had on the company is, well, you certainly hire more people sooner, so the company grows a little bit faster. We're still coming from a bootstrapping culture, and it's a 7-year bootstrapping culture, so hasn't changed dramatically. We're not in the craziness that some of the companies have when they start, you know, spending money extremely aggressively on different things. It's almost something I think we need to be careful about, is to spend a little bit faster money, because that's a common thing for people that have been profitable for too long. But beside that, as a founder, it's very enjoyable to have more financial means to extend, you know, a product and a mission that I care very deeply about. I mean, we worked on this without salaries for 3 years, you know, so it's really something that I really want to happen in the world. I really want someone to solve the problem we're trying to solve. I think we have a good shot of it, and I'm glad I have money to do that now.
From Facebook, Matthias sent me a question. He said, if you're both an engineer and have some business acumen, how do you go about starting your own solo business? There's a lot to do as a solo entrepreneur, or an entrepreneur in general. So how do you prioritize between the engineering and the business side, all the different things you need to do as part of an early stage?
I mean, I'm obviously biased because of what I do, but there are a few tools now that let you do things much faster from to build a product. I mean, Bubble is one way. You have a few other ways to do that quickly. So, I mean, at the end of the day, if you don't have the product first, there's not much to do business with. So I would very much recommend, you know, get a product out of the door as soon as possible. Again, with a few tools, you can probably make that happen in a few weeks, and do that first and then worry about other things. The business side of things is honestly in technology today, especially if you're building something B2C, much less important than it used to be. In the B2B space, it kind of depends a little bit more on the type of bees you're handling, dealing with. If you're dealing with SMBs, small businesses and consumers, there is even a new word, you know, to categorize them, which is like, you know, prosumers, if you will. It's not very different. If you start selling to very big companies, in that case, it's different. I would recommend testing the idea from a business standpoint before investing on the product.
I guess it depends on what project you're building, how you go about testing it. But do you have any advice for how to test something before you've built it?
Well, again, I mean, if it's customer facing, I think the best way to test it is to have something that actually works. And don't try to make something too pretty, but using something like Bubble, or again, I don't want to just, you know, be pitching my own solution. You have other tools out there that let you build something in a week or 2 weeks. Well, invest, you know, the 2 weeks it takes to have something that actually works and you can launch to the world. Just don't try to make it beautiful too soon, because in the early days, it doesn't have to be. For more enterprise type of things, that usually, I mean, people wouldn't start something in the enterprise space if they don't have like a deep knowledge about the field and what the pain point that people are facing. If you don't have that, well, you have to figure this out first, which means talking to people. My understanding is that it takes basically years to, you know, to see that in an industry, and then you start seeing, like, if you're building, for instance, you know, a product management tool for like construction sites, like people building things, if you're not part of that industry, or if you haven't been exposed to that industry for quite a while, it's going to be hard for you to know exactly what people need. One advice I would give, though, and it's something that I see people doing again and again and again, is it's one thing to try to test early, but I would also recommend not to launch too soon. And by launching, I mean having like high visible launch, whether it's, you know, on Product Hunt, Indie Hacker, or in the news, because people tend to do that too soon before they actually have optimized a conversion. When you have those kind of like media exposure thing, it's a one-time thing most of the time. You're going to wait probably another year or two to get another one. And so you want to wait as soon as long as possible while still iterating on the product. So what that means is that try to find kind of what we did, honestly, you know, like find, you know, 50 users that are extremely engaged, that desperately need your product, work with them, interact with them on a daily basis. Like, I was on Skype probably 2 hours a day for the first 2 years with our users to understand what they were doing. Iterate on that before trying to get too many users. My personal view is that, you know, 1 hour conversation with every user per week with 10 users is much more valuable than like 100 users in terms of data gathering.
As you predicted, there's a question in the chat about Bubble specific features. Yep. Mudassir asks, can he create a specialized email client on the Bubble platform for example, connecting Outlook and Gmail? Are there plugins for that sort of thing?
Gmail, definitely, because they have a fairly clean API. Outlook, I don't know what kind of APIs they have. Now, I know there are tools out there that, you know, gather all kind of like legacy email systems, because all these email technologies are pretty old, and package that into a clean API for developers. That's called NYLAS, like NYLAS. With Bubble, the question is more for the service you want to use. If they have like a reasonable modern API, meaning, you know, JSON-based REST API, you can use it in Bubble, basically. Because that's one of the things that made Bubble much easier to build today than 10, 15 years ago, is that the world is moving towards, you know, standardization of those different platforms talking to each other, the APIs, which is very convenient for us because we just need to build it once. You know what I mean?
Follow up, is it available in the Bubble plugin gallery?
Yeah, I think there are a few Gmail plugins. So there are more than one because some people just add one or two calls, you know, like to read emails and send emails. But yeah, definitely.
I was curious about the titles at Bubble. You're co-CEOs, which is not super common. Why?
Yes.
Are you both CEO versus CEO, CTO, or any other combination of C-level titles people tend towards more often?
It's interesting you ask this question. It's usually more of a question coming from investors, because that's one of the things that worry investors sometimes, is that, oh, who's the boss? Mm. We're coming from a little bit of a different history. Like, usually when you see people just starting a company and both being co-CEOs, that probably means they both want to be CEOs and could figure out who it should be. In our case, we actually had no title at all for like 6 years and a half. We were just, you know, founders, and even the team knew we were the founders, and we really run the business together. We've been an old couple for a long time, you know, just the two of us for 5 years is pretty long. And so what we felt with these titles is that it was the best way to really show that the important decisions are all made, you know, in consultations between each other. And we both pushing the vision as much for me than for Josh. In practice, though, I mean, to be very transparent, we have pretty clear roles defined inside the company. So inside the company, people know exactly who to go to when they have a question. Like, our reporting lines are actually very clean. Like, no one actually reports to the both of us. And so that has been working pretty well. I mean, those titles are never set in stone. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't personally really care about the title, Josh either. So we'll do what's right for the business.
What is
one thing I'll add for people that want to start companies is that when I see a 3-person company where you have a CEO, CEO, and CTO, it's kind of weird. Mm. I mean, you know, until you actually have like a real team, I don't think it makes any sense to spend too much time on titles.
Yeah. What do you think has kept your odd couple relationship stable for as long as it has? What are the secrets to like founder relationship success?
I mean, well, first of all, I mean, there was clearly like a personal fit, and even more, I would say like a working style fit. We're pretty different. We tend to work pretty differently, but we have very, very complementary ways to work and skills. And so we were able to do a ton of stuff with just the two of us. Like, to give you some numbers, before we started hiring people, it was just the two of us. We had about 80,000 users. Our AR was close to like, I think, $600,000 a year or something. So like fairly significant numbers and volume, just being the two of us, because we were very good at what we were doing and very complementary. So that's something that keeps you going. I think we both fundamentally share the deep beliefs that what we're trying to do needs to exist, and that we are, at least till today, the best. We have the best product on the market, and so it would be a shame to stop. And so that keeps you going, you know. But I'm not gonna lie. Obviously, over 7 years, you know, it's like, you know, a 7-year relationship with your spouse. You have rough times. It always happens. But then, you know, the commitment to the bigger vision is, or if it's your spouse, your children, or whatever that is, will keep you moving forward. There are things you could do. So after we raised money, for instance, we took an executive coach, which if you have the money to do that, because it's expensive, I very much recommend. Because, you know, most entrepreneurs actually don't know what they're doing because it's their first companies. And you have some people that have seen other people go through there. And so even though all product and all startups are different, I think the problems that every CEO or every founder faces as he scales his business tend to be pretty similar. And so working with someone that has seen it helps, and that helps in particular with co-founder relationships.
And that's, you guys started the company off of just one coffee meeting as well, right? So from that to...
that's what I was saying.
How did you know so quickly that Dasha was the one?
I didn't. So I think there are like a couple of things that happened. So first of all, from a purely rational perspective, you know, the risk was pretty low. Like, you know, I had this person like Charles that already had a very early prototype, but something was offering me, if you're interested, do you want to work with me, basically 50-50, to join me? What was the risk? You know, it doesn't work out. Well, you know, after 3 months, I look for a job and I'll take the job. It's fine. The only risk I was taking was on my immigration status, because I'm still not a citizen. So I had to make sure, like, if you wait too long, then you might find yourself in a situation where you don't have time to sort your immigration status and you have to leave. That can happen. But that was honestly the only thing. And then from an emotional thing, I mean, I think we connected. It was a pretty funny interaction. You know, I arrived saying, it's great to meet, but I have this job offer that is great. It's actually taking care of my immigration status, which for the foreigners that have lived in the US, it's a real thing. You know, when you look for a job, it's actually something that is important, like a strong selling point in your job offer. So startup was pretty interesting in New York. I mean, they went bankrupt after that, but I didn't know that at the time. So I went to that coffee saying, well, it's great to meet, but you know, I have this job offer. It's actually quite interesting. So I'm going to take it, but you know, who knows, maybe, you know, a few years from now, we'll do something. Mm-hmm. And then we started talking. We literally talked more than 3 hours. And at the end, he was like, well, do you want to give it a try? And I was like, well, let me think about it. I didn't say yes immediately. I slept over it. I actually called my school to make sure I was not doing something completely stupid from an immigration standpoint. Talked to some people and some kind of like foreign student advisor. And the guy was like, well, you have a few ways to figure it out. And then I called him. I called the job first to turn it down. And then I called Josh to say, okay, I'm in. One thing I'll say is, not knowing each other. So it could have turned out terrible if we're just not compatible people, but not being friends initially is actually, I think, a pretty good thing to work, because you first behave as professional. I see a lot of people that start companies with friends, where sometimes it's difficult to actually have like, to tell someone you really fucked up something, for instance. It's kind of hard to say because there is an emotional baggage. You don't want to lose your friendship over the business. With Josh, I mean, we became friends. I mean, he was actually best man at my wedding, but it's something that grew on the job. And we started as professional first, which I think is a much better way to start a business. I remember when I was at Harvard, one of the professors I had in entrepreneurship was studying success rate, like what creates a good founding team. What are the traits of good founding teams? And one of the things he was looking at was, you know, how close are you from your co-founder? Like, and so closest being basically married, like a couple, from like friends to ex-colleagues. And so basically those three. I mean, very few people would start a company with someone they don't know. Only me would do that, I think, and Josh. But so, and so what you see when you look at the numbers is that the closer you are to your co-founders, the higher the failure rate is. And the explanation he had, which makes really sense to me, I mean, that's what was coming out of the interviews he was running, was that when you're very close to someone, when you have both, you know, your company and your marriage in the same thing, because at some point, you know, if the business goes bust, the likelihood of your marriage is tough, at some point you're going to give up on your business to protect your marriage or your friendship. And it's something I've seen over and over and over again. Having said that, you know, this is statistics. You have very impressive success stories of best friends starting businesses and actually couples starting businesses. So this is just statistics. Each case is different.
Mudas here has another good question in the chat. He wants to know how you got to the first like 5, even 10 users. What was your tactics and strategies?
It's actually quite interesting. We got them physically through tech meetups. Like with a product like Bubble, like, you know, the level of trust we ask from our users, I mean, with a faith, I would even say, I mean, we tell them, build your business on top of us, and we basically tell them, believe us, this is going to work and we do whatever it takes so that it works, especially when you don't have many users at first, is something that is so much easier to convey face-to-face because you talk to the person, like you inspire. In some ways, we're kind of the outsourced CTO, you know, see what I mean? And so you wouldn't want to do that with a Google ad, for instance. So what we did, and as I said, New York was a great place for that because you have a lot of people that didn't have tech background that wanted to start companies. New York had a lot of, you know, tech co-founder meetups, you know, where people try to go there to find a tech guy. And those things, the promise is that, you know, for one business person, you have one engineer, but it's never the case. It's always, you know, 10 business people for one engineer, if it's a good day. And so we would go there and talk to people and tell them, well, we're not going to be your CTO, but we have this product we're building that, based on what you're telling me, seems like it would be a good fit. Do you want to give it a shot? And that's how we found them. We started in New York, and then we went to the school I had been to, which was Harvard Business School, which is a full of people, like, you know, driven business people that don't have a lot of technical skills. And so we were there, which was kind of a giant meetup and just talking to people on campus. Still today, by the way, today, like, we're bigger. SEO is pretty good for us. Like, if you type, you know, build a web app without code, we usually one of the first things you would see on Google. But in my experience, offline referrals are the strongest. Like, if one of you, if I tell you, hey, you can build the next Airbnb on Bumble, you might not believe me because it's still me trying to sell something. But if your friends tells you, hey, I build this like marketplace and really I could do whatever I wanted, it's fast, believe me, like try it, 100% you're going to try it. And so this offline component is actually very important for our business.
I've pretty much dominated the question asking so far. So if anyone else has questions to ask, please feel free to jump in. Otherwise, we have another one from a pre-submitted question off of the Indie Hackers website. Ashar wanted to ask where you see the future of the no-code movement going.
I think it's going to become more and more mainstream. And at some point, I think it will stop calling that no-code. I think right now we're calling this no-code because it's new. But I think eventually that's where software development is going. Like, software development is going, and that's really the world we're trying to design with Bubble, is a world where business people build the products themselves because they know the product better, actually, because they know usually they're closer to users or the need, or they're trying to build it for you themselves. And engineers only come on board when you need to extend the platform with a feature. So for instance, let's give an example. Like, imagine you're building something like Airbnb, again, the same example. A business person, a product manager who's not very technical, can, you know, design exactly what, not like pixel perfect in terms of how beautiful it is, but in terms of functionality, you know, what happens when you click on this button. If you logged in, this is what you should see. If you logged out, this is something you would see. So engineers, when they write this into code, it's actually not super value added because they don't add anything new. They're just transcribing what, you know, business people tend them to build. Where engineers start building new interesting things is when they start, you know, doing, like, for instance, for Airbnb, the pricing algorithms they have is actually very advanced. If you're trying to do some kind of, you know, machine learning optimization to match people better, for instance, this is the kind of things that an engineer should be building and should be focusing time on. So what I think the world should be, and what we're trying to do, is a world where, so no code is not a thing anymore. Business people, it's a common knowledge that if you need to build something, you can, just using one of these no code tools. But we won't call them no code. And when you need to build something that is more advanced and that is more like pure software engineering, like algorithmic engineering, then an engineer comes on board. So the value of that is that it's a much higher leverage thing because you don't have lost in translation issues between business people and engineers, which is something that happens a lot today. Because again, for very frequently, engineers build something they wouldn't use themselves for many, many occurrences. Business people that know the field much better build it, and the engineers only work on new things. And if I may, if you have a shot at changing the world, and I mean it like literally, that might actually be by, if we or another no-code platform does well enough that it becomes mainstream, we're going to free so much of engineering time to work on real things that who knows what they're going to do, and that's actually really cool. When you look at, you know, companies, you know, like Uber and Lyft, for instance, I mean, or like DoorDash and Deliveroo, or DoorDash and Caviar, those companies are great, you know, but honestly, it's kind of the same thing, like from a engineering standpoint. The fact that these companies have thousands of engineers on payroll is really sad. They should be having, you know, business. Where they actually differ is their business strategy, branding, user experience, but the user experience is often a product aspect, not an engineering aspect. And so the world would be much better where, you know, these companies use no-code tools to have, you know, business people building the product, and they only bring, you know, I don't know, 50 engineers when they're at scale, when they actually need to work on like specific things that, you know, the no-code tool is not great at. Like for Bubble, for instance, building a machine learning algorithm is not something that would be great on Bubble, but you can use Bubble, hire an engineer that would type it, and then it runs on the server somewhere that we have an API where we can host code. And so the engineer just focuses on that. So that's where I see software development going. This should be across all platforms. So today it's only web for most of us. I think the web being like the platform that contains most of the other things, it makes sense to start with that, but we're going to have to expand to mobile definitely. And then what the next platform will be, I don't know, you know, whether it's glasses, VR, like Apple Watch. It's not entirely clear exactly where this is going, but the software development will have to be the same visual platform everywhere. Where I hope that will lead us is at some point, people won't see programming as a skill that is hard to get anymore, and more like something, oh yeah, I want to create a world where, you know, people program without even thinking it's called programming, which is already something that Microsoft Excel has done pretty well. You know, like if you use Excel today to build like even like a family budget, you're basically programming. You know, but Excel has been around long enough, and it's been taught enough in, you know, colleges and even high schools that nobody think about it in those terms, and that has become, I think, this is the most impressive software franchise that we've seen so far. I mean, Excel literally changed how the business world works dramatically. It convert any like business analyst into some kind of a data scientist for small data sets. I mean, now Excel is limited by how much data we have to handle, and I want tools like Bubble to do the same thing with programming. So people will end up, you know, oh yeah, I need to create, you know, this kind of like advanced form to work my new users into something. I'm just going to build it. It's going to take me like 2 or 3 hours. There's no code. And effectively you are programming it, but you don't think about it. And if something at some point is missing, then an engineer will add and build it.
So at some point, Bubble is so advanced, you can code almost anything with clicks and drags that you could typing. Why is it that format, do you think, isn't as intimidating to users? Like, what makes it more accessible to code through like a visual programming interface versus?
Well, so first of all, I mean, we only see like, you know, 1 or 2% of our users actually typing code on Bubble. So for most of our users, what they interact with is a visual interface. And why is it less intimidating? Well, because it's clicks. I mean, it's because it's visual, it presents information in a way that is natural to us. While if you type code, you write text in a way that is parsable by the computer. Like fundamentally, that's the big difference here. So very practically, what that means in Bubble is that if you want to create a workflow when, you know, the user clicks on a button, you want to save the apartment in the database and then send an email. Well, in Bubble, it's going to read exactly as, you know, when the button save is clicked, create a new apartment, send an email, change the page. So it's much easier to parse. You don't make syntax mistakes. You can still make mistakes in Bubble, but not syntax mistake, which are, you know, like a typo. If you type then, but you misspell the N and type an M, it's not going to work, right? So the kind of things that is impossible with Bubble. So the level of details it requires is much lower. At the same time, you still need to think carefully about what you're trying to do, but it forces you to actually think about the interesting things. One of the things that I'd say a lot about Bubble compared to other no-code tools, actually, is that the reason why we call Bubble like a visual programming tool is because you can really do mistakes when you build your app. You know, if you don't put your workflow actions in the right order, you're not going to have the expected behavior. And so you're going to have to iterate on this. But that forces you to think at the interesting level, which is, what do I want to happen when the user interacts with my app? You don't start thinking, oh, shit, I forgot the comma here or the semicolon. That's what is intimidating to people, because you end up, you know, very often in the early years of your programming life, if you're coding, spending sometimes literally 1 hour to just realize you forgot a comma somewhere. That is something that works with some people. That's why, you know, some people love coding. I mean, at the teenagers, you have some type of profiles, and I was one of them, that would really much enjoy the brain teaser aspect that it has. But I think for one person that enjoys it, 9 people in high school would be like, hey, I have better things to do with my life. I'd rather go play with my friends. Education has been always a pretty big angle for us. So I was saying earlier, we did our pilot at the HBS, like Harvard Business School, to get our first users. But we start having more and more high schools actually using us, not necessarily to tell their students they should start companies. I mean, I think honestly, when you're in high school, you have better things to do than starting companies, but to teach programming thinking, which is something, a very interesting concept, I think, which is, which we should train everyone. I'm very much against the idea that we should teach everyone how to learn how to code, because I think for the reason I just talked about, it is tedious and it might actually even have bad side effects in the sense that it might actually make some people think they're not made for technology, which I think really in 2019, you can't afford being not okay with technology. But programming thinking is more, you know, okay, how do I think in a structured way of, you know, which information do I need to save? What happens when the user clicks on this button? What happens if he clicks on this button but he's not logged out? And thinking this kind of like flow chart thinking, which is super useful, by the way, not just to build products. I mean, it's also useful if you are trying to build work on an assembly line as a manager or something. You need to think very structured, in a very structured way on everything that's going on. And Bubble is a great tool for that. So it forces you to think at that level without worrying about, again, the commas that's missing. That's really, I mean, it's really 1970s, you know. It shouldn't be like that in 2020.
What are the current like edges of the Bubble universe? What things are outside of the realm of possibility on Bubble right now? What things are like maybe surprisingly possible?
So what's really tough right now, and when I talk about Bubble, I mean using Bubble without extending it with code. Because today, because you can extend Bubble with code, there are honestly no limits in terms of what you can do. I mean, because if something is not there, just write code. But let's say you don't know how to code and you don't want to hire someone to do that. Bubble is going to be very good at for applications, you know, where the main ways you interact with things is through, you know, images, forms, buttons, maps, these kind of things. If you're trying to be like a platform game, for instance, it's going to be challenging because a platform game creates new user interface elements. Again, if you start writing code, well, you could code the missing part of the platform game and that would be fine, but let's say you can do it. Another thing from a functionality standpoint, the one thing where Bubble is not really good at is, you know, intense data processing, machine learning algorithm. Whenever, you know, the good way to think about it is, can a product manager describe exactly what he wants to build? And when I mean product manager, I don't necessarily mean something with that title, but something with that mindset. So for instance, you know, one of the competing communities of Indie Hacker is Product Hunt. Product Hunt is full of people like this, you know, like people that are not super technical, but you know, they can think of a product and how it should function. When you can think about it, then you should be able to build it visually. A product manager is not going to design in his head. He can design in his head what the application will look like and what it does. He's not going to design in his head what something like a machine learning optimization algorithm would look like. That's where Bubble is not great at.
Do you see a future where there's a like Bubble for machine learning?
I mean, some people are trying to do that, I think, like trying to create something a little bit more visual. So, I mean, honestly, I don't know enough that field to know where is the potential. I'm sure we can do better with high-level things. Having said that, I do think that at some point, understanding well, you know, the different data sets you have and everything will require some kind of low-level understanding. Now, whether it's going to be, excuse me, whether it's going to be through a visual interface or through code, it will still be something that is fairly low-level and not for everyone. And it's fine, by the way. In some ways, I find, you know, this tendency we have to tell everyone they learn how to code kind of weird because, I mean, I hope the world we're going to live in 20 years is not a world where everybody is an engineer, you know, on his computer typing something. That's pretty depressing. At some point, engineering is a specialized task for people that really love it. And for other people, they should not be limited by what they can do with technology because it's everywhere. But we shouldn't expect them to behave like specialists and engineers.
Where do you see, like, what are the current goals right now for Bubble as a company?
Our goal is to be
the next couple of years.
Exactly 2 years from now, I want to be like the primary place where people go to when they want to start a web-based business. We have a very strong focus on entrepreneurship. I'm not trying to get into enterprise or other places. My goal is really, you know, when someone starts thinking, okay, I have an idea for a product that I think could be used by people and eventually either generate like a large community or income or whatever, I want them to start looking at Bubble and being like, okay, can I build this here? Then my guess is that we will never get to 100% hit rate. Like, you know, at some point people will be like, oh, actually I know how to code, or maybe I'll just write code myself, but I want them to come there first. And then hopefully we keep 90 or 80% of the people. That's for the next couple of years. If we do that, then we have a very strong foundation. It's a little bit like what Stripe and AWS have done, you know, like betting very aggressively on very early stage companies first, and then, or even Shopify with like mom and pop shops, offline stores, and then you grow with them, which is something that we've done already, but I want to do it at a much larger scale. And then you grow with them until a point where some of your clients become almost like enterprise type, even though they're not enterprise, but you're already in the house and they start asking you for some features that are more like of an enterprise type of things, like, you know, whether it's compliance or like, you know, large team management type of things. And once we have that, then we'll develop the product for them, because our commitment is always when someone starts on Bubble, we're really allocating more resources to him or her or that team that to potential users that we don't have yet. That's a very strong moral commitment we have with our users. So we build that for them to make sure they can scale nicely on us. And then we use the features we build for this use case to extend in other places like enterprise. I do think there is a tremendous potential in the enterprise space. There is a huge need for like large companies. One of the challenges that we'll have at some point is that if you're not a big tech company, it's very, very hard to hire very good web developers. Because if you're a good web developer, you want to work at Facebook or Bubble or Google, but you don't want to work at, you know, BP. And BP needs software. So BP is great to hire good oil engineers. But for like IT systems, which are very core to anything they do now, it used not to be the case, by the way. You know, like 30 years ago, IT was a support function. Today, any business is some way is a technology business, but they don't have the ethos and attraction power to hire very good engineers today. And I don't think this is going to change. And so there is a fantastic potential and a huge need here for a tool that empowers non-traditional engineers, so like, you know, bubblers or like visual developers or business people to build things themselves, because that will be very needed. One of the key best examples I would give of that is governments. I mean, governments have a lot of issues hiring good engineers. You know, you're a good web developer, you don't want to work for an agency for the US government to build things. And that ends up being, you know, the not great launch of healthcare.gov. Like if you remember like a few years ago where they had this website that didn't work because they just didn't have the right people to build it. We need to lower the bar to create things so that way more people can do it. And so it's not only big tech companies that have these people.
When you're like expanding to meet customers' needs that haven't needed to be met before, is there some pressure you're fighting against to avoid becoming more like an agency format? Like it seems like it would be as easy to accidentally become an agency when you're building.
Yeah, I mean,
software tools.
We've done feature development on request actually quite a lot in the early days. We don't do that anymore, but we used to. My view on that is, as long as you know you build it in a way that is a component, but we don't actually build something just for them. Like for instance, one of our users once, that was like 4 years ago, 3 years ago, emailed us and say, "Hey, I'm building like a voice app where you can register a sound and upload it to the server and then play it back." And it was like, and we didn't have that feature at that time. And it was like, things are moving sooner than I thought. I'm meeting some investors next week. I would love to be able to show them something. Well, that's one of the value of being a very small company. Like I told him, well, for a one-time fee to make sure, the one-time fee was not even to make money, was more to make sure that he was serious. You know, like I think we quoted them like, you know, $3,000 or something, which is not huge, but it's significant for an individual, you know? So if you put $3,000 in something, you're probably going to use it. And then I dropped what I was doing and I was building that. But then now today, everybody uses it. Not everybody, but a ton of people uses that feature. So as long as you build something that is, you know, a component and you retain, obviously, like the deal is always very clear. We build a feature for you, but we retain the IP. So the way we used to call that was sponsored feature. So we basically would sell you the right to change a little bit our priority list. If you do that, you make money on a one-time basis as a service, but you don't provide a service. You just improve your product, so improve your software development. My concern here is not necessarily to turn into an agency, but more to have too many features that go in too many different directions. And so sometimes we would still say no, just because we think it was not a good feature, and so then we would say sorry. But today some features I might be like, that's kind of weird because we pretty much close to feature completion. But 3-4 years ago, honestly, there weren't that many ideas that were bad because we were in the early days where we just needed all these features.
Are like freelancers and things using Bubble as well for client
work? Yeah, actually it's an important driver for us. my guess is that 20% of our growth probably comes from agencies. What's interesting with these agencies, so it has changed a little bit now that Bubble is a little bit more well known, but for the early years, it was always like former users. So what we saw, and that is very much our acquisition model, you know, to get new clients, is someone discovers us. At that time, there was a lot on Product Hunt, has an idea for a product, so learns Bubble, build a product, realize it's not going anywhere because most startups' ideas are actually not very useful. But then he has, hey, now I have this skill where I know that I can build something in like 2 weeks that would probably take like 3 months to a traditional development shop to do it. Why don't I try to build like a disruptive, to disrupt a little bit the market by offering a much cheaper price, but that still make me a very good living for the number of weeks I work on, because Bubble is much faster to build. And so we had a lot of people doing that. If you go to bubble.io/agencies, you would see all those agencies. On the top of my head, I would say probably 60 or 70% of them are like former users that converted into agencies. And the reason why I say it's an important driver for our acquisition strategy is our best users right now are people that hired a Bubbler. So I believe, you know, it's kind of an inside evangelization system, if you will, where you get people when they're pretty young, building their own thing, even if it's a side project, then they become aware of where they can build. And then they start being hired by a company. And then they realize, which is the case in every company, which is, you know, software is not moving fast enough for the business needs. And at some point, you know, that person will stand up to go to his boss and say, well, actually, you know what? I think I can hack that pretty quickly if you let me do it. And then, you know, if the boss is desperate enough, which often is the case because engineering is slow, then after a week he's like, oh, wait, you did this? And then, you know, the guy takes another dimension inside the company, and that's how we start having more and more apps inside the user. We had, like, I could think of at least 10 accounts at Pearce on the top 10 decile of what we have that started that way.
It's interesting. Do they become considered like an engineer internally, or like would it,
you know, are they considered I don't know, actually it depends. I mean, I we have some users that introduce themselves as technical co-founder now. Mm-hmm. We have some people that actually are proud to say, no, I'm not an engineer, but I still build things. Usually they call themselves bubblers, but bubblers is really in the context of Bubble. But whether they want to picture themselves as engineers or business people that can do things without code, it's up to them. My guess is with the rise of the no-code movement, we'll see more and more people being like claiming loudly that they're not engineers and they can still do things. 3 years ago, that was more challenging. I think 3 years ago, people would say, oh yeah, I build it with, you know, a visual framework or something, trying to not get too much into the details of it because it was kind of a stigma to be a no-code tool. Now it's changing.
Is that just because the mindshare has increased that these tools exist, or why is that?
Yeah, yeah. And the tools have gotten better. I think the market pressure for what we do is stronger than ever, and I don't see it going down ever. The need for software is more and more everywhere. At the end of the day, whether you want to start a company or whether you're running an existing business, productivity gains are going to come from like automation technology. And so everybody's fighting very hard. Business situations change fast. The development cycles of products has gotten a little bit better, but it's not accelerating the same as a business situation. And so everybody needs faster something that fits the need. And that's why, again, like a way to describe what we do is no code tool, but another way to describe what we do is really, you know, we make building things much cheaper and faster. And that pressure is a very fundamental one that will stay being there and that will make products like ours more and more widespread.
Bringing it back to like your plans for the next couple of years and expansion, you mentioned that your focus is still on like people starting companies. You want to be like the default choice. What do you see as the roadblocks to being the default choice now?
So there are two things. I mean, one thing which is not a problem for people, but like we need a few large success stories to make sure that people have faith when they build on top of us. Technically, that means we need to improve a few things around performance. That's probably the biggest issue we have right now. It's a challenging problem, you know, because when you let people build things without exactly knowing the technical aspects of it, they tend to do things that are not optimized. Like basically they build database queries that are really not optimized. And so it's kind of the business we're in to make sure it works regardless. And so that's what we're working on a lot right now, but that's from a technical standpoint, that's a bigger thing. From a user acquisition standpoint, back to the success stories, I think our biggest work is an evangelization work, to be honest. Today, we still hear, for instance, you know, we have some drop people that start using as they realize, oh, it's going to take me 10 hours to learn and then drop. The reason why is that, of course, I mean, we could try to invest to go from 10 hours to 7 hours, but 7 hours would still be too long. The real problem is a communication issue. If people knew and believed us that, oh, after 10 hours, you can build Airbnb without code, they would spend the 10 hours because the same people spend, you know, 200 hours in Code Academy with actual limited results, or even worse, $10,000 in boot camps, you know, to learn how to code. So the real problem for us here is evangelization and communication issue, trying to make sure that, you know, people actually believe that this no code thing is real and that you can build, like, you know, fully functional products. It's not easy because, again, the no-code space is booming, but every product out there has a little bit of a different offering. And like, you can't build Airbnb on Webflow, for instance. Airtable is great for what it is, but you can build a web application on top of it. And so it's a little bit of a, you have some noise a little bit in communication. So at some point, our biggest roadblock is to figure out the right way to make sure that our value proposition is extremely clear to our users, that they believe us, at least most of them, that it's working. And then we'll get to, and then I think things will be much easier because, again, economically, from an economic standpoint, time to market and time to iterate, which is another great value of having something that is faster to build. Like, honestly, like, today, if you, between Bubble and Code, I mean, Bubble is much, much, much advantageous because if you want to iterate on your product within a week, you'd get something that would be much, much, much faster than if you hire engineers.
What's here in the chat is asking about becoming a Bubble evangelist and...
Yeah, so we actually just started something a little bit inspired by the Indie Hacker evangelist chapters, which I think was pretty interesting. And so we already had that was happening organically. We had the users that were organizing meetups and just being very vocal Bubble enthusiasts in their local environments without being officially affiliated with us. And so we created what we call a Bubble Pioneer Program, which is a way to empower more people to do this and have more support from us, whether, you know, it's in terms of content, logistics, sometimes even financial, if some stuff has some cost. To try to help them, again, to foster this community approach that we have. We have a very active forum online and offline people to talk a lot. Because again, I think the best way for people to trust that it's worth investing the 10 hours it takes to learn the product is to have someone that tells them that it actually works, that is not part of the team. And that's where the pioneers come in. So if people are interested, the best way is probably either email support@bubble.io, mention like this Indie Hacker interview and meetup and the Pioneer program, or go to the forum and search for Pioneers. I think if you Google Bubble Pioneers, it should just be the first thing, but I haven't checked.
Pablo is asking about the recent price changes for Bubble plans and what are your future plans around pricing?
That was a little bit of a rough one, actually. So we did increase our prices, like, to be very blunt, significantly, 80%, which sounds enormous. The truth is we were very much underpriced compared to pretty much any other tool on the market that was having the same capabilities that we had. And some product on the market that are more in the enterprise space, I mean, charge literally 1,000 times more than we charge. So we were charging $16, and so we bumped it to $29. I can't tell for sure. Honestly, I'm glad we did this. It was painful to announce it and people were upset. But economically, we're starting to be in a situation where the long-term value, like the value of a customer, was not high enough to sustainably grow, which was really not good for anyone. I mean, that's what kills a product eventually. And so I'm glad we did this. I'm not envisioning anything else in the near future. We might do some experiments to try to find exactly the right price point. I mean, is it 29? Is it 25? Is it 32? Is it 23? I don't know. We might do some experiments there, but I don't think anything dramatic. That's what I can say on pricing. It was a tough announcement when we announced it. One of the advice I would give to people that want to start companies, and it's something that happens to a lot of people, is be careful not to underprice too soon, because at some point you want a ton of market share, and so you think underpricing will be the right way to get there. In practice, it's going to be tough to change that. And if you underprice too much, you end up killing your business, to be honest. I mean, we were fine, but it was really blocking, and it still is. I mean, because people that signed up to Bubble before August 15 still have access to the old plan. So the economics we're having are fine. They don't necessarily prepare us for like fantastic growth, which is why we had to change that.
What was your retention after you did the price increase? Did a significant number of people stop using the platform, or were most people still finding plenty valuable?
Yeah. I mean, like, people are very upset. I mean, I know, I think 5 people left, but you know, it's 5 people that were paying $16 and they're like, okay. I mean, they left more out of an emotional thing because it's still, we were grandfathering everyone anywhere, you know, so the prices didn't change for them. But that was it. Like, you know, I think rising prices might be a little bit of a challenge, like in, you know, countries like India or like, you know, emerging markets where, you know, the cost of living is different. But like from people in the Western world, I mean, honestly, telling someone you can build like your startup, including like all the web services, everything for $29 a month is more expensive than 16. But honestly, I think it's still very much affordable. It's like an additional 4 coffees a year, a month, you know, or like 2 glasses of wine to experiment a new idea. I think it's something that people can sustain. So that hasn't had
flat pricing across the board.
No. So it scales with traffic. I mean, obviously, if you start having a lot of traffic, it's going to be much more expensive. That's kind of how the system works, which is something not necessarily super easy to explain to non-technical people, because non-technical people don't always understand that, you know, traffic scale and data queries come at a cost. I mean, there is a computation cost associated with them. But yeah, right now, I think the highest paying customer we have is about $8,000 a month, and they have like a lot of traffic. But if you compare that with how much it would cost them to hire a fully engineering team, like that's something I have in mind. If they were to build that with an engineering team, they probably would have 5 or 6 engineers. So, I mean, this plus hosting and their business in San Francisco is probably close to $100,000.
Yeah. If they're saving just one engineer, then it pays for itself.
Yeah, I mean, like, pretty much no one pays us more on a monthly basis than the cost of one engineer. But that's where Bubble is actually a truly disruptive technology. Like, you know, everybody talks about disruption, but if you think about what disruption is from a like academic standpoint, like disruption is offering a product that is much easier to adopt and much cheaper than the competing solution. And at the beginning, you're not going to be good enough as the existing solutions. You know, today, if you have like a very good engineering team, it's probably going to be better than a Bubble built app, but we're getting to the point where we're pretty close. And if we're pretty close, at some point, economically, it makes no sense to go for the old technology, which is hiring engineers, and you just go for the one that is much, much, much cheaper. It's exactly the same thing that happened, you know, with USB chips versus hard drives, or like, you know, digital cameras, where at first the quality of the images was not as good as the old cameras, but it was much easier and cheaper to operate on because you didn't have to develop the pictures and everything. And now, you know, an iPhone is really competing with like professional non-digital cameras, and pretty much no one uses those non-digital cameras anymore, except like a few people.
Paulo wants to know if you have any affiliate program plans for Future of Bubble.
It's very much something we're considering right now. I don't have a firm answer because you have two things, referral program versus affiliate program. So I have to see which one is the right one. I will need a few weeks to work on that, but yes, we're going to do something. The difference being a referral program means more, if you bring some of your friends, you get some maybe free capacity for us. For instance, you would get more server capacity like Dropbox did, you know, you would bring friends and then you have more storage. We did try affiliate programs in the past. I think affiliate is great for people that have a lot of reach, like someone that's a big blogger or with a big following base, because it can be good. The challenge is, again, back to our pricing, we're very, very cheap. And so if we give, you know, 10, 20% of the money we're getting from someone, from if you bring one friend, you might end up with literally $2 a month, which is cool. But, you know, $2 a month is not a great outcome for you. But yeah, we're going to be working on engineering something there.
And for anybody new that came in, feel free to hop in with questions on audio or drop them in the chat. Yeah, either way works. So how did you get from like the first like 5 to 10 to like say the first 100 users? Was it door to door the whole way?
No, I mean, we did some of the door to door, but that was probably for the first like 30, 40 users. And then, so we were starting to be visible in a few entrepreneurship hubs. By hubs, I mean like a few we selected a few incubators or accelerators. So we went to Harvard, so we went to the Harvard Innovation Lab. And so that by itself brings probably something like another 20 users per cohort or something. And usually those users are very committed because they're full-time on that, so they're great. The first major visibility thing we did was Product Hunt, which we did actually fairly late compared to where our product was. It was in October 2015, so 3 years in, and that went very well. And still today, we get a lot of traffic from them. We ended, I think, for people that are familiar with the number of upvotes, I think we're close to 5,000 upvotes on Product Hunt, which is a great place, even though it was like 4 years ago. I mean, we did a few other launches there, but that was really the key one. Because whenever someone searched for like, you know, web development tools or like no code, we tend to be one of the top two, which works pretty well. After that, we had some press. To be honest, my experience with press is that it's better for branding, for recruiting, for the team morale than for user acquisition, interesting enough.
Where does most of your like user acquisition come in now? Is word of mouth or SEO or?
It's both, yeah. Word of mouth and SEO. Word of mouth being both online and offline. So people tweeting about us, people writing blog posts about us, or offline through this actually like pioneers that are not called pioneers yet because we just launched it, but people just organizing local events. Someone, you know, at an incubator say, hey, look at what I built. And that spreads pretty well that way.
Is there any topics you wanted to touch on that you didn't get a chance to, or things you want to communicate to the universe at large?
Let me think. I mean, we covered a lot of things. Yeah, I guess one thing I'll say is no code is cool now, but the level of skepticism is still fairly high from a lot of people, and not necessarily engineers only, around, you know, oh yeah, this is cool. You can do an MVP, but it can't be a real thing. And what I just want to tell people is, you know, just take, and I'm saying that for Bubble, but it can be really for any no code tool out there. Just invest, you know, that two or three rainy Saturdays in the afternoon and believe, trust us that, you know, this is actually much more powerful than you think. And it takes a little bit of time to see that because at first sight, if you go to our website, you know, it's hard to show the complexity of the product built on us, except if you actually log into that product and use it, you know, it takes some time. At first, if you go to Airbnb, it's going to be a website with pretty pictures of apartments, you know, is it actually dynamic? You don't know until you actually bought an apartment, right? I mean, now you know because it's a big brand, but otherwise you wouldn't know. So I would highly recommend, trust us, it's worth it. You know, spend, you know, the 10 hours it takes to just see how far you can go, because you'd be surprised. Like pretty much anyone, we never had that issue of someone emailing us saying, oh, this is not as powerful as I thought it was. It's more, oh, this is more complicated than I thought, which is something we're working on, trying to ease the learning curve. But on the other hand, it's really about 10 hours where you can do a lot of things on us. And the other thing I'll say is, and it's still very true today, when someone starts building seriously on Bubble, we have a very strong moral commitment to make sure they can scale on us. It's something I take personally extremely seriously. And, you know, from me and Josh is going to the whole team. When we tell people to bet basically their businesses on us, which in some ways, you know, you ask them to bet their lives. I mean, like if the business goes bust, I mean, they're like in big trouble and sometimes even personally. This is something we take extremely seriously. And so if someone is on us and start doing well and start hitting limitations of the platform, we'll do whatever we can to remove them. And that's, I'm using this opportunity because so it's videos. It's kind of the speech I was, you know, having like, you know, 6 years ago when I was at meetups. It's a little bit the same thing. And it's still important today. I mean, we have much, today it will be much easier to accommodate a lot of people because the platform is 7 years old. But, you know, it's going to be honestly an ongoing battle for the next decade. Like for the next decade, I'm really hoping we'll get users that find some limits in what we have because that means we're doing well. Our team is extremely committed in solving that because at the end of the day, there is nothing more rewarding to me than seeing businesses that do better than we are on top of all. I love building enabler tools because people can create things that I didn't think were possible. And in fact, we have quite a few users that I think make a much, much better living than I make personally. And I found that truly extraordinary.
That's pretty incredible. And you could build something and then people are building even bigger businesses on top of yours.
Yeah. Like almost. Yeah, I mean, that's something I found very, very, very cool.
Pratik in the chat asks, what are problems that you wish beginner indie hackers would solve? maybe like startup ideas or problems that you see in the market?
I mean, I think it's kind of related to Bob a little bit, but I think there are many ways to tackle this. I think computer literacy and tech inclusion is, to me, one of the biggest challenges we're going to have to handle in the next 5 years. Something that we underestimate a little bit. Right now, tech is seen as bad, you know, with, you know, privacy issues and stuff like that, with like Facebook had some issues and those big companies having too much power. But fundamentally, the problem, and that's kind of back to what I was talking about in the early days, in technology is too expensive. The other way to look at the problem is computer literacy and making sure that everyone, first in the developed world, but then in the developing world as well, can have access to modern tools at a cheap cost is extremely important. Otherwise, we're going to really have like a two-class society with a few people in like basically San Francisco and New York or London, very well-paid building things that everybody else uses without any control on them. And so any idea that helps with this computer literacy problem is something that I think is extremely necessary. What that looks like, whether you know it's in the education space, I don't know. There are a lot of ways to solve that. I have a thing for education personally. I was teaching in high schools for about a year full time, and I can't say that was my best job because I love my job actually right now, but that was pretty close to that, honestly. But I think there are like a lot of very interesting things we can be doing there, and that are necessary. I don't think we need more food delivery startups.
Well, okay. What is the very biggest version of future bubble? Like if you reach the pinnacle of your current vision?
Well, I think the people that we do well, what we're trying to do, will become the biggest tech company in the world because they will defy, like in the same way that Windows made Microsoft, Macintosh made Apple. I think the companies that is going to be able to empower people to do something that used to be very hard and expensive into something very easy will completely change the technology landscape and will be gigantic. So I'm hoping to be that company, that create basically a new standard, how programming works, how people build things, how people even interact with computers. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is to change how people program computers, which is one way of interaction. It's a long-term game. My guess is that it's probably another 10, 15 years from now. But that's really what I'm hoping. What I can say for sure is that will happen. The question is, who will make it happen? My guess it's going to happen from a new company because large tech companies, even though they start looking at no code, they look at it from a very engineering centric standpoint, except maybe Microsoft, but we'll see. But I think there is something very promising there, and I want to be that company.
Well, I've completely exhausted every question I had for you, and it's been entirely enlightening. If anyone else has any questions, like now's the time to ask them. You can hop on with the chat or the video, but otherwise, Emmanuel, it was amazing to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me. That was a very pleasant time. And if I can help with anything, just, you know, let me know. Drop me a line. Awesome. Or something.